Hello, thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of chef, author, documentarian, and TV personality Anthony Bourdain. We're joined by his longtime assistant and writing partner, Lori Woolever. Lori is a writer and editor and spent nearly a decade assisting Bourdain, with whom she co-authored Appetites, a cookbook, and World Travel, an irreverent guide. And just yesterday, Woolever's latest book came out, Bourdain, the Definitive Oral Biography, which features interviews with nearly 100 people from all facets of Bourdain's life, from childhood to his final years. Lori is interviewed by Nate King, Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum.
Lori, thanks for being here with me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I wanted to start a little bit. Could you just tell me a little bit about yourself and kind of how you, and the book as well, and how you got to know Anthony and all that?
Mm-hmm, sure. So I have been living in New York for about 25 years. I came here right after I graduated college, and my goal was always to be a writer. At that time, it was 1996, there wasn't really any internet publishing, and it really was a matter of getting your name in print, which was, I wasn't sure I would ever actually see my name in print. So it was, I had to figure out what to do, how to position myself in order to be taken seriously as a writer. I ended up going to cooking school so that I would have some kind of a subject to know about and write about. And that, and also I enjoyed cooking and I enjoyed food, and I thought this would be a good way to kind of combine my interests. So I used that as a stepping stone to start working as a food writer, at the same time working other jobs, because as I think many of us know, being a writer is not a path to financial solvency in a lot of cases. So one of the things I did was work as an assistant to Mario Batali at the end of the 1990s and the beginning of the 2000s, which was a very educational experience and a great experience in a lot of ways. And Mario introduced me to Tony Bourdain maybe a year or two after he had written and published Kitchen Confidential, which was his big breakout memoir, beautiful book about his experience, his life and his experience in the restaurant industry. And Tony was looking for somebody to help edit and test recipes for his first cookbook, which was called Anthony Bourdain's Layal Cookbook. I had done that kind of work with Mario Batali, so I was kind of a natural fit for this job with Tony. He hired me sight unseen based on Mario's recommendation. And that was my first time meeting him and working with him on that book as a sort of limited project. And then several years passed, I began to work as a magazine editor, again, in the food space, first with a magazine called Art Culinaire, which is a quarterly, full-color, beautiful magazine. It's sort of a collectible among chefs. And then at Wine Spectator, which is a collector-focused consumer magazine about the wine business. And then I had a baby and I wanted to sort of shift gears and be able to spend more time at home and have a more flexible life. And I reached out to a number of people, including Tony, and said, I'm looking for part-time work. Here's what I can do. Keep me in mind if you hear anything. And right away, Tony wrote back and said, my assistant is actually on her way out. Would you ever consider taking that job? I know it's not really what you're doing in terms of being an editor and a writer, but I think it would be a good fit. And it was, it really was. And so that was a job that I did from 2009 until the end of Tony's life in 2018. So that's how I came to know him and work with him. He was himself a writer at heart, someone who had published already two crime novels before he published Kitchen Confidential. And then he went on to continue publishing. He wrote another crime novel called The Bobby Gold Mysteries. He wrote a sort of a nonfiction follow-up, to Kitchen Confidential called Medium Raw. And the two of us co-authored a cookbook together in 2016 called Appetites. And then we had just started another collaboration on a world travel guide that, in fact, was called World Travel, an irreverent guide, meant to kind of collate some of the best experiences that he had over his long career as a television travel host. Unfortunately, we didn't get too far into that work before he died. So that was a book that I had to sort of finish on my own and figure out creative ways to incorporate his voice without his living presence in the world. So that was published earlier this year in April of 2021. And at the same time, shortly after his death, the idea came up in a conversation among myself and Tony's longtime editor and publisher, Daniel Halpern at Echo, and Kimberly Witherspoon, who was both of our literary agent, to do an oral biography of Tony's life. And so that is the book that's coming out very soon. It's called Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography.
Yeah, and it's great so far. I'm curious why the oral biography format?
Sure. So this format in which I did about 100 interviews with people from all aspects of Tony's life, from his now late mother, Gladys Bourdain, his brother, Christopher Bourdain, his first wife, his second wife, his daughter, friends from high school, friends from the bad old days cooking in the 1980s and 90s in New York City, his publishing colleagues, his television colleagues, and a lot of other people he met along the way. This format really reflects the way that Tony was a storyteller, in that he would find and gather a lot of people whose stories he was interested in, ask them questions, and then sit back and listen to their answers and let them speak for themselves in their own words and tell the story of the food of where they're from, or the conflicts, the politics, the living conditions of places all over the world. So I thought it made a lot of sense to do the book in the same way. And it really gave me the opportunity to meet a lot of people I hadn't met before who were part of Tony's story, and also to kind of reconnect with people whom I did know through working with Tony. And the timing was really auspicious in that we were all in the early stages of grieving, and to be able to come together with a purpose, talk about Tony, talk about our memories, interrogate what we knew about him and what we had sort of conclusions we might have drawn after his death, was really a very useful and cathartic exercise.
Hmm. That's neat. So it's the oral biography is almost like a homage to Tony's life himself and his kind of personality and what he gathered from people.
Absolutely. His way of, he was a great storyteller of his own stories, but he also was very skilled at letting other people tell their stories, and never sort of, when it came to telling stories on television, on film, he was very careful not to insert himself into someone else's narrative.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you mentioned he's always, you know, was always a writer. That's one thing that sort of fascinated me, was just his, even while cooking full-time, his commitment to writing. Was that something he had his whole life? Even, you know, like you said, you had met him after Kitchen Confidential came out, but still, was that sort of his process? Could you talk about his process a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it is touched on in the book that there was a period where he fantasized about being a writer, saw himself as a writer, had a vision of the life of a writer, I think well before he actually got very serious about writing. I think some of his process for maybe a decade was dabbling. He made the acquaintance of Joel Rose, who is himself an accomplished writer, in the 1980s, when Joel had a little literary magazine called Between C and D that Tony very much wanted to be published in. So he sent Joel some comics that he had illustrated himself and also done the writing for. And Joel sort of famously said, "Well, your drawings kind of suck, but your writing's pretty good." And that really kind of focused him in, because Tony was, as a young man, an aspiring illustrator, an aspiring comic artist. And at some point he grew sort of frustrated and disillusioned with the fact that maybe his work, his illustration wasn't up to par where it needed to be for him to break into publishing. And sort of like what I was saying, when I was a young person trying to break into writing, was even more true for Tony when he was in his 20s that there was, without the internet, there was a greater level of gatekeeping and it was a much higher bar to actually see one's work in print. So Joel helps Tony kind of focus on what he was really good at, which was writing. And he dabbled for a long time. You know, working as a chef is an incredibly demanding job, and you know, having the kinds of colorful experiences and adventures that Tony had as a younger man, including a stint as a heroin addict and a cocaine and crack user. Those things take up a lot of time, right? And don't leave you a lot of time to be a serious writer. It was really only after he cleaned up from his various narcotic addictions that he did focus on writing, and he did kind of do one of his many life reinventions. I'd say in the early 90s, he began to get very focused. He took a writing workshop with the legendary editor, Gordon Lish. And Joel talks about that as well in the book, that he was a little concerned that this was going to have an outsized impact on Tony and his voice and on his process, but it didn't. Tony remained very true to his own voice and his own style of writing. And it was in 1995 that he published his first crime novel, Bone in the Throat. So it sounded like that he was, it was after the misadventures of the late 80s and early 90s that he developed a really admirable and difficult practice of getting up very, very early in the morning and going directly to the computer and starting to write. And I say it's admirable and difficult because he was working as a chef, you know, 12, 14 hour days, physically demanding, mentally taxing. And then oftentimes he'd be out after work having a couple of drinks with his colleagues. And so if you do the math, it's like, when did this guy sleep? You know, right. not very often. I think on his days off, he probably, like many cooks and chefs, didn't get out of bed. But he was very committed to this vision of writing a novel and then a subsequent novel. And so that was how he was able to get it done, was early morning spurts of writing that really served him well. So, and I think that was a practice that as much as he could, he tried to hold on to throughout the rest of his life. Now, when you're traveling and constantly crisscrossing time zones and sometimes up for early morning shoots, that gets in the way. But he was somebody that really thrived on having every hour of his day scheduled. So somehow that the pressure for him was what helped him be a productive writer.
That makes sense. Because yeah, I mean, I've worked in bars and restaurants during my life as well. And there's no way I would, like, if I made it to the shift the next day, let alone get up beforehand.
Yeah.
But I do understand the pressure, feeling of pressure too, though, that sometimes gets you motivated, or if you, like you said, if you have a whole day scheduled, then you have to get it in certain times. Mm-hmm. Another thing that interested me was his promptness for everything. A lot of people in the book mentioned he was always not even on time, but for him, on time was early, you know?
Yeah. Pathologically early. I mean, it was kind of a joke among people that knew him, and you only had to show up on time once to realize that on time is late for him.
Yeah.
So it was always, you know, if you know he's going to show up 10 minutes early, you try and get there 15 minutes early. So it was just, you know, it was a measure of his, I think, something that had been drilled into him. And he talked about this in Kitchen Confidential, something that had been drilled into him by an old boss who he called Bigfoot, who was a man named Andy Menschel, who unfortunately died shortly after Tony. I really would have loved to have interviewed him for this book, but he was unavailable. So that was something that was drilled into him when Tony worked for him. And then I think also it was a measure of his good manners and his respect for people. And I think that people are sometimes surprised by this dichotomy where he's very brash and he sometimes would say outrageous things and, you know, is very quick to sort of point out his own flaws and his own shortcomings as a person, but he had really beautiful manners. He was really very considerate of people. Eric Repair talks in the book about how the first time they met, they had lunch and he was really kind of blown away by his table manners. And so I think it's a mark of that he never wanted to leave somebody waiting and he never wanted to be late.
Yeah. Yeah. You bring up the the dichotomy too. That seems to come out a lot in a lot of different dichotomies, even I would say, and so far in my reading of the book is you get a very full sense of who he is as a person and father and husband, ex-husband, you know, all these, the whole sense of his life, which I think is a testament to your work in the book, because I did want to talk a little bit more about your process in writing an oral biography, because that, mm-hmm. you know, I took journalism and I went to school for journalism. So in one class, I decided to do oral biography, and it's a lot of work. mm-hmm. You know, the interviews on one hand and the transcription and then piece them all together. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what your process was in getting the book together.
Sure, absolutely. I was at first incredibly daunted by this project, but I have done enough projects now to realize that that is part of my process, is to, when the contracts are signed and the thing starts, I often am like, oh no, what have I done? You know, this, I can't do this. And if I can just, you know, if I sit with that for a couple of weeks, then some magic happens and then I get to work. But I do always start with self-doubt, with radical self-doubt. Sometimes if it's a big magazine feature, I'll sit there hoping that the magazine folds so I don't have to do the story. It hasn't happened yet, which is good. I would hate to be the, you know, the psychic downfall of a publication.
Right.
I can't get my shit together. So one of the first things I did was meet with someone who had undertaken a similar project and just got a sense of what it involves and what their process was in order to just understand what I was getting into. Having worked as a magazine writer and editor and done other projects for a long time, I have the interview part of it was very comfortable to me. It feels like that was the easiest part, really, was sitting down with people and talking, and in some cases talking for a really long time, you know, much longer than, you know, there's a lot more material than I was able to use. But those conversations, and as I had said earlier, those conversations were very therapeutic and very helpful and very, and sometimes super personal, very emotional, a lot of tears, some anger, so a lot of laughter too. So I worked kind of slowly because I was also at the same time writing world travel. So, and that was due before the biography. So I knew that I needed to work concurrently, but also that I had to really put the foot on the gas for world travel. And so slowly over time, I did these interviews with people, and most of them in person. At some point, the pandemic made that less possible. So there, a lot of them became phone or video interviews. And I use the services of a transcriptionist for almost all of them, because I just some people love transcribing and I don't understand what's wrong with them, but for me it is such a painful process, and I know that it's worth my time to pay somebody to do it and do it quickly and well, you know, much better than I could do myself. I have a really excellent transcriptionist in Montreal who was recommended to me, and I was just on Instagram and I posted a picture of the book and he said something like, congratulations. And I said, I literally couldn't have done it without you. I mean, I just, you know, it's such an undervalued skill. And I, you know, the automated system, the automated transcription services that are available. And it's just not the same. To have a smart, sentient, thinking human being do it is really for me is the way to go if you can afford it. Anyway, I did a lot of the interviews, but I knew that I couldn't wait to do all the interviews before I started building the manuscript, because I would have run out of time. So the more interviews I did, you know, I would sort of read each one of them through and just, you know, it's hard for me to really pinpoint what my method was, because I feel like I did it in sort of a fugue state. Like if I look back now, I'm like, how did that happen?
Yeah.
But to the best of my recollection, and I think we sort of black out as writers sometimes. So we sort of, you know, you forget the pain, especially when you're then presented with the finished printed product. You know, it's like having a baby, you know, you forget labor and because you've got this baby in your arms. So it was a lot of, you know, reading and rereading the transcripts, a lot of highlighter and underlining and, just kind of constantly massaging this material and going through and knowing right away what some of the most important points were, and just throwing things in. There's like a very easy, lazy kind of sculpture metaphor, and I'm not a sculptor, so it seems a little bit too obvious, but this idea of starting with all the material and cutting away and cutting away and cutting away and refining until you got something. I tried to the best of my ability, I tried to leave all the natural speech patterns and stops and starts and funny turns of phrases. I really tried to leave that intact as much as possible. In some cases, there had to be some cleaning up. You know, it becomes a service to the reader to make things slightly more smoothed over. And this was something I struggled with a little bit with the concept of the audiobook version of this, which is, I take these raw recordings, which are people really speaking in their own natural cadences. How do we make that into an audiobook that's actually a pleasant listening experience?
Yeah. That's interesting.
Ultimately, that's not, I think for everybody's benefit, that's not what happened. We had people go back in to the studio and read their parts as they were slightly condensed and edited and smoothed over a bit for readability. It's a really interesting thing to now listen to the finished audiobook and hear people saying their own words, but in some cases it's very readerly, versus the natural speech pattern. So it's, and I think that's okay. I think that it is all, it points up sort of the importance of editing and the importance of, even if something reads very naturally and sounds natural to the ear, we know as writers and editors that there is always work that goes on to make it so that raw transcripts are raw and exciting, but a polished piece of work like this is an entirely different thing. So
yeah,
that answers your question, but
yeah, totally. I hadn't even considered the audiobook portion of it, so that's interesting. So they came in and recorded their own parts of the book?
Yes. Yeah. Of the 91 interview subjects in the book, I think we were able to get like close to 80 of the actual people. In some cases, people were not available. Unfortunately, a few had passed away in the interim. Right. But we got as many as we could. And then the audiobook producer was so good at what she does, Suzanne Mitchell. She was able to find very close voice matches.
Oh, nice.
And even sort of temperament matches for the people who weren't able to record their own voice. So it's a really extraordinary thing. I mean, I hope people buy the physical print book, but I also would encourage people to listen to the audio book, because it's a really special experience.
Yeah, for sure. You just mentioned too, transcripts coming in and usually need a lot of work. I actually just read the chapter where they start talking about Anthony Bourdain's work on Treme, and a lot of those, the David Simon show. And a lot of those writers were like, we didn't have, his stuff came in and we didn't have to do too much to it. So I don't know. There's something, I don't know if you could speak to his kind of, not inherent, because he did a lot of practice and a lot of studying, but he's just kind of has a knack, like you said at the beginning, knack for storytelling, whether that's orally or in a book or on the screen. So yeah.
Yeah, he
seems
was
so special to me.
He was a very clean writer, and a lot of people remarked on that. Certainly David Simon and Lois Eli both were really impressed and made their jobs easier if Tony was sending in scripts that really just needed cutting more than anything else.
Right.
And that was my experience too, working with him. In as much as I was hired as an assistant to do kind of basic admin things, I also sometimes Tony would send me a piece of writing and ask me to give it a once over, and which was very flattering and really like a huge compliment to me. But honestly, there was very often very little to do, you know, apart from cleaning up some punctuation or maybe, you know, asking if something could be phrased in a more clear way. But he was such a clean writer, and such a, you know, his first drafts were better than a lot of people's polished drafts. And I wonder if it was because of that time pressure. As a chef, he didn't have all day to sit around and sweat out and edit and really labor over a sentence. He had to, you know, it's the same kind of thing being a line cook or a chef. You don't have all day to precisely arrange things and think about the sauce. You have to be constantly producing at a very high and very precise level. So I think some of that may have bled over into his process as a writer.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you don't have time to overthink that sentence you just wrote. You kind of just have to move on to the next one. And yeah, and I think that comes across too in reading it. It sounds like someone talking, you know, his written voice sounds like someone's speaking to me. I want to talk a little bit too about, if you'd like you said, you collaborated with him on the cookbook. I wonder, cookbook writing to me has always been fascinating. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about what that was like to write a cookbook together and,
Sure. So I had done other cookbook projects and felt comfortable in that world. I had done a lot of recipe writing for magazines. And so the mechanics of recipe writing, that part of it was not a challenge. I hadn't really co-authored in this very prescribed way before, let alone with someone with such a strong voice like Tony and such a strong point of view. And so I knew that my role going into this was to help him tell his story and make sure that his voice was front and center and do the kind of technical heavy lifting that he both had no interest in and did not have any time for. So that being said, it felt like a true collaboration in that he had a number of recipes that he definitely wanted to include, but there weren't, you know, I think our goal was to have something like 75 or 80 recipes. And he was short of that. There were only so many that were kind of near and dear to him. So it was on me to suggest others that fit in thematically with what he had suggested, but were not necessarily top of mind for him. So that was the first part, was deciding on the list of recipes and doing all the work of developing them, testing them, writing them, rewriting them. And then each recipe has a head note, right? And then there were also a number of essays. And Tony wrote the essays wholesale. And I was there to just maybe clean them up a little bit again, you know, fix up some punctuation, make things more clear, maybe ask a few questions if I felt that there were things missing. And then he would go back and fill it out a little bit more. And the head notes, I would say, so I wrote all the head notes for the book, which kind of are really, to me, are the most, sometimes the most interesting part of a cookbook, you know, those bits that tell you the who or the why of why this recipe is here, or just some essential piece of information that for one reason or another doesn't fit into the method. Or sometimes it's just a joke, or it's an observation, or it's, you know, something very kind of off the cuff. So I wrote all of them very much trying to channel Tony's voice and then pass them off to him. And he rewrote some of them, and some of them he left intact. And now it's 5-6 years later, I truly don't remember which ones he wrote and which ones I did, which I think speaks to that kind of seamlessness that we developed over many years of collaborating. And then really one of the most fun and most creative parts of the book was the photography. And Tony had a lot of kind of out there ideas about how he wanted things to be shot. But he didn't want to go over the top, and he didn't want to kind of make it, he didn't want to go too far over the top, right? So I'd say half of the photos are really bizarre, in some cases, frankly, unappetizing. Or there's some kind of a visual joke that is not, you know, is not ultimately the way that the food looks on the plate, but there's something that we were able to play with. And then the other half are pretty much just straightforward, beautiful food shots. And there was a really fun, involved collaborative process between myself, Tony, the photographer, Bobby Fisher, the food stylist, Victoria Granoff. She had a whole staff of people working for her. It was this kind of two-week party where we were making these weird scenes happen out of food. And it was just, I think the result kind of speaks for itself, but I had never had that experience of really sort of project managing a book on every level like that. And it was so instructive and so much fun. And, you know, especially working with someone like Tony, who had maybe more carte blanche than many authors. The only limit was our own sense of taste and style. So you know, we did reject some concepts ultimately, but it was so freeing and so much fun to be able to just do the weirdest, funniest shit for this book. And then the cover is a sort of challenging illustration by Ralph Steadman, which again was Tony's idea. He really was a big fan of Ralph Steadman's. And so he commissioned Ralph to do a portrait of Tony, which is sort of abstract and a little bit very, very typical Ralph Steadman style, to the point that some retailers wouldn't stock the book without a paper modesty cover. I mean, it's not a vulgar image. It's not a violent image, but it's not what you expect on the cover of a cookbook, which I think makes it so brilliant. But some of the big box retailers who make very significant purchases of these books said that they needed some sort of so we had a plain paper cover in those big stores for the book, which was very, very funny. And I think, you know, kind of Tony got a kick out of that. That
right.
So outrageous that it had to be sort of brown paper wrapped like a, you know, like a marital aid or something.
Yeah. That's funny. Ralph Steadman, of course, makes me think of Hunter S. Thompson, which now I'm thinking maybe that was, you know, Anthony Bourdain is kind of like the next in the lineage of that. Did Anthony Bourdain have any favorite writers that he looked up to a lot or any that influenced him a lot?
Yeah, well, Hunter S. Thompson was a big one. That he was a young teen, really, when he started reading his stuff in Rolling Stone and some of the collected books. I think it was a big influence on him, that kind of work, the gonzo journalism. William S. Burroughs. I made this joke yesterday that it was kind of just the disaffected white male starter pack of readers. It was nothing too outrageous, but those two writers for sure. And then, you know, musicians who kind of lived in that same outside the law style. He was a tremendously voracious reader of everything, but especially history, especially 20th century American history, crime novels, Sherlock Holmes. You know, his brother talks a bit in the book about how there was a family trip to France when they were in their teens, and they had to bring all their own English language books because they were in the country, there weren't English language bookstores. And so they brought the collected works of Sherlock Holmes and they both read it over the course of the summer. There's a great picture of Tony in the book with his brother, and they're quite young and they're reading Moby Dick. I think, you know, American classics. But he was deeply, deeply interested in Cold War spy stuff. And so anything he could get his hands on around that, and also JFK assassination theories.
Yeah, I like that part in the book fascinated me, or maybe not fascinated, but it's just like, I think the line, I forget who said it, but it's like, he was like the first, he knew about the JFK assassination before anyone else, all the now commonly known theories. He was on like the cutting edge of those, which what about working with Anthony Bourdain? Because you worked with him for almost two decades, right? How did that, working with him and the spheres that you worked, impact your life and career?
Sure. He had a huge impact on me. Arguably having contributed to his cookbook first, really sort of set the stage for a lifelong friendship. Lifelong is too strong a word, but from then on, I was a known quantity to him. I was somebody that he trusted because he was happy with my work on the cookbook. And I was, you know, I enormously flattered just to be able to sort of labor in his shadow. He was a master of hyperbole, and a number of people talk about that in the book. Okay. And in my case, you know, he wrote this in the acknowledgments for Anthony Bourdain's Lay Out Cookbook. He wrote this absolutely hyperbolic note about me and my work that just still thrills me. I had no idea. You know, he was not in person a very effusive, you know, person with praise or affection. But on the page, you know, with the safety of remove, he was enormously kind and charitable. Or he would always talk really, he would always speak very kindly and again, very sort of hyperbolically about people who he liked and admired, but never when they were around. You know, I would always, he would just sing the praises up and down of his various crew members and different friends and colleagues. And I always thought, God, I wonder if he talks about me like that, but I never heard it. And then once in a while, somebody'd say, oh, Tony was saying how great you are. You know, it's like, okay, good. You know, so just from the outset, getting to know him and just being in his orbit as somebody who was, he was very generous with trying to bring people into that orbit, trying to share the good luck that he had of being in the right place at the right time. Also, you know, possessed of a talent that he had nurtured on his own. So he was very generous about opportunities for me, you know, for instance, co-authoring a cookbook, because it was a huge opportunity. Before that, I started doing line editing on some of the books that he published on his imprint at Echo, which was called Anthony Bourdain Books. Again, some of the, just the casual, editing and writing and a little bit of ghost writing that I did for him. I mean, that just felt like a privilege. And he pulled me on to his television show in 2016, did a Queens episode. I live in Queens in New York City. And they did an episode where he needed somebody, kind of a neutral party, to come and be a sidekick at Aqueduct Racetrack and drink beer and bet on the horses and, you know, just sort of talk about nothing of consequence, really. So I did that. So, you know, he was, and I saw this, it was, wasn't just me. I saw this all around that he was, he wanted people to grow and succeed. And if that meant outgrowing whatever it was that he was doing, he was okay with that. Although I will say, as much as the guys that made television with him could have gone on to do any number of things while he was still alive, he inspired a real loyalty, both because of who he was and his charisma, and also because they were making television at a very high level. And in the same way that we were able to really art direct our cookbook in a very unusual way, he and his crew were able to make exactly the kind of television and exactly the kind of short films that they wanted to, with very little pushback from the network, which is an extraordinary thing. You know, I think a lot of very talented people are making The Real Housewives and Sister Wives, right, and, you know, F-Boy Island, and, you know, God bless them. I mean, it's all great entertainment, but I think it's a really extraordinary opportunity to make beautiful, thoughtful work that really moves people. So, yeah, you know, no complaints as far as working with Tony for so long. You know, once you had proven yourself to him, he was going to be there for you always. You know, there was always going to be a job or an opportunity or, you know, some way to continue to collaborate. I think he valued loyalty as well. So if you were willing to stick around, I think he was very interested in rewarding that.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Do you have any like favorite stories with him or anything that, cause you know, you interview a lot of people, but other than the, you know, your introduction, I wonder if you have any stories from the time working with them or any ones that stand out. I'm sure you have plenty, but any of like particular fond ones.
Yeah. Well, he was really generous too about allowing me to sometimes travel with the crew when they would be making television. At some point, a few years into the job, he said, if you want to choose a location, you know, one location a year, wherever it is, you'll go along with us. I'll pay your expenses and you can hang out and you know, watch what we do. Or if you want to pitch a story to a magazine or a newspaper about the place that we're in, that's very attractive to an editor because you've already covered your expenses,
right,
and you're not, you know, in an ethically clean way. and then you're there. So that really, that was great. That was, you know, so I had a number of really amazing experiences with him. The first one was in Vietnam in 2014. We went to Central Vietnam in the city of Hue. And I wasn't an experienced traveler. I had never been to Asia at all. And I was a little nervous and a little hesitant. And Tony, you know, who had been to Vietnam dozens of times and was arguably his favorite place in the world to visit, just made it so easy and comfortable for me. And he could see that I was a little nervous. And, you know, I left my 4 or 5 year old child at home and wasn't sure whether it was worth it for me to take what I considered risks, which really were, you know, getting on the back of a motorcycle with a motorcycle taxi driver, or hiring somebody that I didn't know to take me out into the country a little bit to see temples and maybe eat some food outside the city. And Tony just said, you know, just go with your gut. And here, why don't you get on the back of my scooter and get comfortable with riding on a scooter and see how it feels. And then you'll probably feel more confident and able to kind of go and explore and do your own thing. And so it was amazing. I mean, just, you know, I didn't really get starstruck too much around Tony, but just this sort of ridiculous perfection of riding on the back of a scooter in Vietnam with literal Anthony Bourdain, you know, even though he was my boss and somebody that I was in touch with every day, it was just like, I can't believe this is happening, you know, and it was just relaxed and fun and very natural. There were a couple of trips to Japan, which were truly extraordinary. And, you know, it was these little things. It wasn't some amazing out of this world, like, you know, 2-seat hidden ramen place that nobody knew about. It was just going into Shinjuku the first evening that we were in Tokyo and just picking the first yakitori place that we found after we got out of the taxi, and seeing him so happy to be showing somebody Tokyo for the first time. Again, Tokyo, a place he had been a number of times, a city he had a great love for. It was my first time there. And just to see this, and there were no cameras and there was no incentive. It was just him showing a newcomer how great the simple things in this city are. You know, it was, and for some reason he wasn't spotted, really. There was nobody approached him. There weren't that many Westerners around for some reason. And he was just able to relax and just enjoy the experience for what it was in the moment. And it was such a happy memory for me that later we went and crossed the street and got ramen. I mean, arguably we had 2 dinners at once, which was too much food, but it was fine. And then we walked around the Golden Guy, which is this little area of very, very small bars, these little Warren-like streets and these little tiny bars. And in some cases, they only seat 4 to 6 people. And you know, it may be a bit of a past its prime obvious tourist destination, but he didn't care. He loved it. It was something that captivated him his first visit to Tokyo. And it still was a place that he always wanted to check back in on, no matter how many times he'd been there, no matter how much of the rest of the world he had seen. It was like, had a really special place in his heart. So again, to have that, have him share that and be unironically enthusiastic about this thing was pretty great.
Yeah. I can imagine. That's one thing that's I've been drawn toward him is his appetite for life, you know, appetite for all the food too. I think it's in Kitchen Confidential. He tells about the dinner in Tokyo where they just keep eating and they keep, the chef tries, just keeps giving them all the different servings of all kinds of everything you can imagine. They just keep eating and they impress the chef. I think that's just his willingness to try anything and go all in is just so impressive to me. So the book is Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. Do you have any takeaways that you hope readers get from reading the book?
Yeah, I think that even if somebody is quite conversant with Tony's writing and the work that he did on television, I think there's a lot more to know about him. I think that public-facing, consumable version of Tony is very appealing and is very charismatic, and is certainly, you know, what made him so widely known and loved in some cases. But I think there's, as is the case with all of us, there's so much more to a person than just that sort of bright and shiny side. So I think that people will just learn more about the totality of who he was as a human. And for those who are left with a lot of questions and a lot of confusion around the circumstance of the end of his life, I hope that this book will also provide some sense of a greater understanding of how a person might get to such a tragic ending.
Thanks for doing this with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks. Same, Lori.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. The next episode will air October 27th. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, come and check it out in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.